Today we are interviewing Ken Catlett. Ken is a beef and dairy cattle farmer in the area. My name is David Wallace, and this is the St. Catherine College Project of Oral History. A little information about Ken to start with. As I said, he's a dairy beef cattle farmer. He also has corn and alfalfa. He's been married for 30 years to Jean, has three children, Greg, Jennifer, and Walter. Greg's 25, Jennifer's 23, and Walter's 16. I want to start off with kind of a personal question, Ken. What's your birth date and where were you born?
Well, Dave, I was born in Jefferson County, Kentucky, on October the 17th, 1932. So, come October of 85, I'll be 53 years old.
When did you begin farming?
I was born on a farm in Jefferson County and lived on a farm all my life, and except the years I was in college and military service. I was married in 1955 while I was in military service, and then I came out of the service in 1958 in May, and have been farming on my own ever since, in May of 1958.
Now, before we go on with that, I also would like to ask you, we were talking before the recorder went on, and you were giving me a little bit of background. Could you give me a little bit of background, how long your family has been in Kentucky?
Well, my Catlett side of the family came to Kentucky during the Civil War in 1862, one or two. My grandfather, Frank Catlett, was born in Catlett, Virginia in the year of 1840. As a captain in the Union Army, he served in Kentucky, and evidently he must have fell in love with the Bluegrass State, so he came back after the war and settled in the area of Harrodsburg and Lawrenceburg area of Kentucky. And then he raised nine sons, which was one of those was my grandfather, who was a farmer in that same area of Anderson and Mercer counties, Spencer counties. And my father was born in Anderson County in 1902, and he migrated down to Shelby County and Jefferson County, and that's where I was born in 1932. We've all been farmers or carpenters. My dad was a part-time carpenter. Back during the Depression, he milked cows and carpentered both to make a living. And on my mother's side, we're also traced back since 1780 and coming from Maryland, of a family name of Greer. It's very prominent in the Nelson County area today, the name of Greer. And they were also farmers all their lives. So our background is English and Scottish, and we came from there, both sides of the family, and we were farmers there, and we are farmers in this country most all of our life. Most all of the Catlett's are farmers.
Well, after being overwhelmed by farmers here, this may seem like a simple question, but is that the reason you went into farming, because of the background, or a combination of background and interest, or exactly what?
Well, Dave, you know, being raised on a farm, you look back 30, 35 years on your life, you just wonder. I went to college and I majored in accounting and business administration. I served in the military service. I said I was a captain in the United States Marine Corps for 4 years. And I guess it's something about being a farmer, the love of the land, that brings us, has always brought our family back to being farmers. So I can't explain it much more, but I'm glad and happy that I have been a farmer. And if I had a chance to do it over, there's days when I have my doubts, but I suppose I'd still be a farmer.
So you started in 1958. Was that in Nelson County?
I started farming in Shelby County in 1958 when I was released from the Marine Corps. My father and mother lived in Shelby County at that time, and that's where I started farming. I bought a farm in 1958 by my own. My father helped me purchase the farm, co-signing my notes and so forth. and that's where I started. And I've owned a farm there, and a few years later, we moved to Henry County, which is an adjoining county. We were there for 5 years, and then we've been in Nelson County since July of 1970, and we intend to stay in Nelson County as long as we live.
When you started in Shelby County, what kind of farming were you doing?
I was doing the same type, dairy farming. We've always been dairy farmers. My great-grandfather, who was the captain in the Union Army, as I mentioned, Frank Catley, was a dairy farmer. And my grandfather was one of the first 6 shippers to ship graded milk to the city of Louisville. And we used to ship milk on an interurban car that ran to Shelby County. It's on the tracks. It's like railroad tracks. And we shipped our milk to Louisville on an interurban car, and those tracks were taken up during World War II and made into tanks and war materials. They pulled the tracks up. I can remember that as a small child, watching them take the tracks up and ship them off to be melted down to make them guns and tanks and so forth.
Oh, my goodness. Your first farm, how large was it? How many head?
132 acres, my first farm was. And I've never been a big farmer, Dave. I stress quality over quantity. I've never been one to see how big I could get. I've always tried to get better. And I'm an advocate of the fact that I don't think we have to be overly big to make a living. I'm also operate on the theory that you will never get rich farming. And so, whenever you think you are going to get rich farming, you'll get in trouble. And I think today in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, we see a lot of farmers in trouble. And we had some unusual experiences in 1970 and the 70s, and they got in their head that they might get rich farming. And that's a terrible mistake, because farming is not set up to get rich.
While we're thinking about it, since you mentioned it, what were some of the things that did happen in the 70s that these people overreached themselves? Or
overreached. Well, you see, we had no presses to draw upon. We never had seen $6 wheat or $12 soybeans or $4 corn before in our lives. And people overreacted to it. They just thought it was going to go on forever. You can't live out here on a farm if you don't understand a few basic principles. And one of those is a professor told me when he went to school, said if it's one thing that you remember in life, and this too shall change. No matter what you do, and especially farming. I had an agriculture course, a fellow by the name of Dr. Hall, and I'll never forget it. And he said, if I could write one line that was describe agriculture, and said, most all of life, this too will change. So when you see good times, don't think they'll be good forever. And it doesn't only happen in farming. Don't you see it happening in other businesses? People who have overextended think it's going to be good forever, and all of a sudden it just dries up.
Certainly.
It's gone.
Sure.
So you see, that happened to us in the 1970s. That's what happened. We had some really good times. We had some things happen that we never had happen to us before in agriculture, and people just overreacted. They're normally, it's a normal rule, farmers are very conservative lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But we got a little carried away. And the people, when I say farmers, let's talk about agribusiness. That includes the people who lend money to us or supplies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They got a little carried away, too. They just couldn't loan us enough money.
Right.
They wanted us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were in the business of loaning money, and they were making money by lending money.
Right.
And so it's just a combination of things that happen. In my opinion, you see it happen to International Harvester, didn't it? See what happened to them. They're now gone. There's no such organization anymore as International Harvester. Only a few years ago, they were the world's largest machinery, agriculture machinery seller and manufacturer.
Right.
It's unreal that they're now gone. That happened to them in the 70s.
Mm.
So you see, and in my opinion, in the mid-80s, I hate to say this, but I think the farm credit system in the United States, including Federal Land Bank, is broke. Now, they will have to get subsistence from the federal government or some outside source to maintain themselves so they get back on their feet. But they're insolvent right now. And I can remember my grandfather borrowed from the Federal Land Bank. He was very proud of the Federal Land Bank. He didn't trust banks very much because they went broke. You don't remember that, and I don't either. But I can remember him talking about it. But he was very proud of the Federal Land Bank.
Let's go back for a minute and back to when you started farming in 58. How many dairy cows did you start with?
I started with a barn that we used a stanchion type barn. That's where your Hauser cows and individual stanchions in the barn. We had 24. And I have never gotten much above that. As a matter of fact, right now I'm milking around 40 cows. It's the most I've ever milked in my life. For most of my life, I milked in the low 30s in dairy.
What major problems did you have in the late 50s when you started? What were the problems involved in dairy cattle farming and farming in general, for that matter?
Well, I guess I could say the major problems in 1958 were the same problems I've heard my father and my grandfather talk about in the 20s, and I can tell you about in the 70s and 80s today. And you try to get the most production you can out of your livestock at the most economical way as possible by raising the feed on your farm. And the problems we have is weather, insects, and weeds, and so on and so forth. They haven't changed much. Now, we have different ways of coping with them. We have more chemicals today to control weeds and insects. We have hybrid seeds today that we didn't have when we first started out, which are some improvement. But remember, hybrids also have drawbacks that the old open pollen type seed didn't have. But if it's one really improvement in dairy livestock industry, in my lifetime, and we were one of the first to use it, and it started in the mid-30s, was artificial insemination and the development of bulls of superior genetic quality. If there's any one item that has really, really helped a small family farmer, it has been that. Because you see, as me as a small farmer, I'm milking 40 cows, I have access to semen to use to breed my cows on the best bulls in the world, known bulls in the world. Where in the old days, only the rich man would have bought that bull if we had known about it. And the first thing he would have done was have only used them on his cows and wouldn't have allowed me to use any on mine. That's been one of the greatest, that is probably the greatest improvement in the dairy business to date. We still feed our cows basically the same feed to make them give milk. That hasn't changed. And the feeds were the best when I was a boy, are still the best today. But the best feed is the cheapest one. And each day and each year and each month, you have to refigure. And if you're buying feed, which one is the best buy? But basically, the same feeds make milk today. But if it's one thing, it's really been an improvement. And what you could do in the old days, you could find one bull that you would use on your herd would just really help you out. You know, his offsprings would be quite superior to the parents. Then you could get three in a row that just take you the other way, just destroy your herd. But see, you don't have to do that today. That you got proven bulls to use, and you can use them at a very reasonable cost. So if there's one thing that's really made it a progressive for the livestock man, it's been artificial insemination. And the sad part about it, it is not used very extensively in our country. In some countries around the world, I took a trip to Europe last year, they're 100% AI, artificial insemination, their dairy. And they, by the way, are overproducing too, and their biggest argument, or you hear comments over in Germany and in France and Switzerland, is too much American semen from their good bulls and too much cheap American grain. It's caused them, their cows, to give too much milk and overproduce milk.
Were there times in the early days that you were fighting for survival, or did you ever think about getting out of the business, or did you have to hang on at times?
No, I cannot really truthfully say that I ever, only 1 year that I didn't make a payment on my farm. And there's no problem. I've always financed through the Federal Land Bank. And they have a program, I assume they still have the program. I don't have a loan with them at the present time. That you, you know, you can pay ahead. And also, the first 5 years we had the loans in the original days, old days when we bought the farms, the first 5 years you didn't have to make the principal payment. And this bad year I had was during one of those years, the original 5 years. And what it amounted to is we had a hailstorm that tore up all of the tobacco. And two or three other, we had a drought on top of it. It's the only year that I didn't make a payment, and I could have made a payment that year if I really wanted to, but Jim Price, who was president of Federal Land Bank, said, you know, if it's going to strain you, just don't skip it. Doesn't matter. I was ahead at the time anyway. No, I can truthfully say I've never had to struggle to make a payment. Now, I didn't say that it was easy, but I've never been in a bind or wondered if I was going to make a payment or anything of that nature. Now, there's plenty of people have, and I don't mean to say that bragging, but I started out, when I got out of service, I had $3,000 and three rooms of house furniture, my wife and I. So we borrowed all of it, but we started slow and took it one step at a time. And see, the reason I feel that I never had any trouble is the fact that I never overextended myself.
So when you started in 1958, you were already married. Did yes. Did your wife help out on the farm? Was she involved in
No, she never has took an active part as far as actual working on the farm, other than maybe go to town and get some parts or run errands for you or something like that. But as far as actually getting out and milking or helping on the farm, very, very little.
She employed elsewhere?
Or? Well, she's done other things. Used to work in kindergarten schools and play schools for young preschool children. And when we first got married, she did that. Now she's, for the last 7 years, has worked with the Stephen Foster Drama in Bardstown, Nelson County here. And which, by the way, they're now on their first international tour of Japan.
Right.
And so they're very proud of that. But anyway, she's never taken active part, no, as far as doing the work.
Was this a one-man operation then when you started?
One-man operation. And, I've never had over one hired man at any one time, and haven't had a hired man full-time for the last 15 years, just myself and my children, mostly doing the work.
All right, so the children came along. One of them's in the room with us now.
Oh, yes.
Exactly, how did they get involved? At what age did you put them to work? Did they work in the farm, or exactly? Exactly what happened there, can you remember?
Yes. They started just as soon as they learned how to drive the tractor. That's always the first job, you know, the young boys wants to drive first.
All right.
And as I can understand, I always like to drive myself. It's better than throwing up hay bales.
Yeah.
So they've been in it ever since they could go to the field with them, you know, 3 or 4 years old. Start them out.
We were talking about how the kids got involved in farming, what some of the things they did.
Well, they, of course, like all boys, and I did myself when I first started farming, you start out with the small chores. They feed the calves first and just kind of work themselves in doing more and more each year as they get older. And both the boys still on the farm. Greg's 25 and Walter's still, of course, in high school, 16. And Jennifer, now she's the daughter, she never worked on the farm. She's kind of like her mother a whole lot. She did a little tractor driving and used to help a little around the dairy barn, but not a whole lot.
Well, while we're at it, you say your son at 25 is still on the farm. So he plans to take it over, or does he plan to expand? Has he been to college with farming in mind, exactly why?
Well, he's been to college, at St. Catherine College in Springfield, junior college, and they've had some agriculture courses there off and on. He's taken those and other courses, and right now he's, of course, planning on farming. And think in the future that he and Walter, that's my 16-year-old, will probably take the farm over. At least we're planning on kind of one of them or both of them. And as far as expansion in the future, we're anticipating going into a hog operation in the future. My oldest son is talking about it and planning on maybe doing that too, so they support more than one family in the future.
Going back again, we keep talking about 1958, but did you have anything besides cattle at that time?
No, in 1958 I only had dairy cattle and tobacco. Okay. And tobacco, of course, in Kentucky is a pretty big thing, and I raised then about 3 to 4 acres tobacco, along with 25, 30 dairy cows. And that continued on to about 1963, and I moved to a new farm in Henry County, and we run about 35 cows, I suppose, then, and had about 8 or 9 acres tobacco. Our tobacco base increased considerably on this farm in Henry County, and we had about 200 acres there, too, where we raised our feed. And we stayed there until 1970, when we moved here to Nelson County, and we've continued milking in about 30-odd cows or thereabouts. And we only had about 2 acres tobacco in Nelson County. Tobacco bases are not very large here. And actually, we've only raised that 1 or 2 years since we've been here. We've either leased it out or tenants have raised it, but we've about pretty much given up the tobacco base as far as us raising it and trying to do too much with it. And we've added to Nelson County, now we've added registered Angus cows, beef cattle, we've averaged it.
Is this the first time you have?
Yeah, this is the first time we've really been in the beef cattle business since we've been in Nelson County. And that's because we have a larger farm. We didn't want to increase our dairy because that increases your work a whole lot when you increase your dairy cattle. So we just took a little less labor-intense project and went into the beef cattle.
How does the Angus cattle, how do the beef cattle differ from the dairy cattle?
They require, if I'm not mistaken, labor-wise, I think the university figures one dairy cow equals the same amount of labor as about 7 beef cows. So that gives you an idea in labor intensity. And you probably make as much money out of 1 milk cow as you do 7 Angus cows, too, net dollars. It's not near as much money in the Angus cattle as there is dairy cattle.
And how many of you, how many did you have in 70? How many beef cattle did you have?
Oh, well, around 40 cows or 45 beef cows.
When you started with tobacco in 58, was that something that you did to help you survive, or was it just a variety?
Yeah, it was our biggest money crop. In 1958, if you farmed in Kentucky and Shelby and Henry and Nelson counties in this general area, the way a young man paid for his farm was he run enough dairy cows or beef cows or whatever he did to make him a living. That's what he tried to do. And he took his tobacco crop and made his payment on his farm, made his payments on his farm. But for me, that has changed over the years because tobacco is just, I've just not put very much emphasis on tobacco.
Yeah, is that anything to do with, I don't want to open up a whole can of worms, but is that anything to do with the problems that tobacco farmers have had during the years?
I began to lose interest in tobacco in the early 70s, when more and more evidence was pointing out that it was a health problem. And I could see the storm clouds in the distance that tobacco is going to get into big trouble. It may take 10 years. I was saying this in 1970. It may take 15, but it's going to get in big trouble. And I don't see any future. Placing your future hopes upon it is a financial way of supporting your family or making a living. And I still say that today. Now, I didn't say people were going to quit smoking. But I think that the American people will not long tolerate forever financing tobacco as a health hazard with the taxpayers' money. I don't think that'll come along.
of the tobacco industry and the fact that you have a little bit of tobacco, but you really don't have much confidence in it.
Well, just I was mentioning before, Dave, that I don't think that, like I said, in 1970, we began to quit raising tobacco because the evidence was piling up against it as far as health hazard, and I don't think that it will be. You'll have government support. You'll have a government program for raising tobacco in the future, and it seems to be that a lot of people, of course, will disagree. I think the evidence that health people are coming up with is pretty accurate. I realize that some people in the industry think it doesn't cause all the problems that they say it does, but I smoked for 25 years, and I can pretty well tell you they're kind of true. So I gave up smoking along with giving up the tobacco. I think there's a lot of truth in that health report. And it's just too many factors working against the tobacco, and it's not going to be a way of life in Kentucky that it was has been ever since they settled the country and moved tobacco from Virginia over here. Now, I know there's, like I say, there's a lot of farmers are going to disagree, but I think it's we can now in 1985 begin to see this happening.
How has technology affected the dairy or the beef cattle? I guess you could take them one at a time, the dairy cattle industry. You've partially answered that, but...
Well, of course, like I say, the biggest technology, I think, has been the artificial insemination. And, of course, we've had a lot of technology as far as machinery, I think, is the biggest thing. People forget there's about three pieces of machinery on a farm that has revolutionized America. And one of those is a chopper that makes silage for livestock. Another one is a combine who threshes and gathers all of the grain, hundreds of acres a day, some of these big machines that we used to do it all by hand. And a hay baler. It's just about three pieces of machinery that's kind of revolutionized. Take a lot of drudgery out of raising crops and harvesting them. So those things have come along over my life, well, not all of them over my lifetime, but a lot of them. And as a matter of fact, I can remember us getting our first one. And that's has certainly changed. In other words, we used to fill silo. We were involved with every neighbor in a 2-mile radius. We all got together and filled my silo today, and we'd get together and fill yours tomorrow. But see, we've kind of broken up our neighborhood, these three machineries, pieces of machinery that I've mentioned to you, broken up our neighborhood. You always had a neighbor to you work with, put up your hay. Because, you just couldn't get it in by yourself, or you and your one member, your son or something, you'd always have to take some extra help. But now we got our hay balers, we can put our hay in each one of us separately. And we used to thrash wheat and take the whole country. I'd take my horse and wagon, we'd haul your wheat to the thrashing machine tomorrow and mine the next day and on. So like I say, we've kind of broken up our neighborhoods. We don't need neighbors like we once needed them.
How about milking machines? Did you always have milking machines?
Well, I can remember the first one we had was run off of a Delco, powered, and it milked one cow at a time. It was a little Delco powered motor, and it sat in the barn right behind the cow that you were going to milk. And you ran the vacuum line straight from the pump. Of course, you know milkers operate off of a vacuum. And over to that one unit, and we milked that cow. And I can remember what one person would run the milk machine, and everybody else would milk cow by hand, each one of us. That's how we got on quickly. And then as time went on, of course, milk machines are much better, more sophisticated today, but they work on the same principle. Still, milk comes out of the end of the tit by vacuum, and it's still about the same principle. And, of course, like I said, the biggest advantage in that end would be the fact that we used to milk the cows. We squatted under them, and we stood on the same level with the cow. Mm-hmm. And you had to sit on a little milk stool, or you had to get down and squat on your knee to get up underneath of them to milk them. Now we've gotten smart. We raised the cow up. We have an elevated, what we call elevated parlors, and that's where the cow comes in, and her udder is at a comfortable level, about like your kitchen sink, where you can work standing up. That's one of the biggest improvements. Matter of fact, that is a tremendous improvement. If If we all had to milk cows the old way as far as getting down and getting under them, it would be a lot less cows milked tonight. And so that saves lots and lots of labor.
Does it take very much money to get into the dairy industry? Is it difficult to get established in it these days as compared with 1950s when you got in with $1,000?
Well, 1950, yeah, I had $3,000 of my own money, and my father co-signed the notes and so forth. Well, of course, we have to first understand that in 1958, dollar was worth a lot more than a 1985 dollar. So you had to start talking then, and. But yes, it does. It takes a lot more. It's the most expensive industry per worker in America. In other words, if I can put you to work on my farm as a full-time employee and buy enough cows and machinery to make you work full-time, it costs more to do that than it would to put you in any other factory or business in America. In other words, I spend twice as much to put you to work as General Motors would to put you to work to build a Chevrolet car. If they're going to employ 1,000 workers to build cars, they have to invest so many hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars. But I invest twice as much to put you to work in the dairy industry.
Is this discouraging the development of family farms?
Well, sure it is. It's gotten to, it's nearly to the point that the only way you can enter farming now is through family relations. You inherit a farm or you take over your father's farm, or it's getting to be that you just don't start from scratch like I did. You know, the $3,000 or $4,000 and somebody co-signed your note. Because what it amounts to is farming is not paying its way. It's not an economic sound business.
As far as the future is concerned, does that mean that there are going to be fewer and fewer and larger farms?
Absolutely. The die is already cast as far as I'm concerned. It's going to be fewer and fewer farms, and they're going to be bigger and bigger. And they're going to cost more and more to operate. And where we like it or not, that's the way it's headed, and it don't seem that we can. It's been going on since World War I, I guess, between World War. Mostly it started in the late 30s when they started in World War II. Since then, it's been dramatically dropping the number of people living in the country, make their living from farming.
How has the government, the federal government, is what I'm talking about, affected dairy farming, or for that matter, farming in general?
Well, as I remember it, there was a guy come along back there named Franklin D. Roosevelt, had a New Deal. And we're Republicans, and we vote both ways. And he started out with the help, of course it was in the Depression, we couldn't have been any lower, and first thing he did was to kill all the excess baby pigs so the hog prices would go up. You plowed your wheat under so that you wouldn't harvest too much wheat and so the price of wheat go up. And in other words, that was the government's introduction to agriculture. And as far as I'm concerned, you see, for a while it looked like a great improvement. As far as I'm concerned, it's been kind of downhill ever since, as far as the family farm is concerned. And I think it proves it out. Since it started in the 30s, people started leaving the farms in droves, and they've never come back to the farms. And it sounds all well and good, but these people have to do something. They have to go to factories, and I don't think there's too many jobs out there now to send our excess farmers to.
Are you saying that I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying the federal government is discriminating against family farms in favor of other types?
Well, I don't say they're discriminating. I just say their policies seem to favor larger farms. And I don't say that because I'm prejudiced. I say that because it's true. Because the federal government got into agriculture in the 30s. And you can go check the records and see how many farmers we had in the 30s and checking some we've got in 1985. And they've become, since Reagan, Ronald Reagan has been president since 1980, okay? It's been more money spent on agriculture than any time in history. And are we not outside of the Great Depression of 1933 or 2, when I was talking to Franklin D. Roosevelt, the farmer is in worse financial shape today than ever since that day. And he spent more in his administration than any other time. He spent more in his administration than any administration or that ever was spent in agriculture. In total dollars. And we're worse shape, because we can hear it around the country now. They're going broke.
And you made a statement before we started this tape, low those many hours ago or whatever it was, about the different types of farmers. And do you recall what you said?
Well, there's three types of farmers as far as in America today. You got the big farmer who could be a cooperative. We hear a lot about cooperative farmers, own the corporations and so forth. Well, a big farmer doesn't always have to be a corporation. He could be just an individual or a partnership. But anyway, you got your large commercial farms, you got your family farms, then you got your part-time farmers who may have a job in town working, or his wife may have a job in town working, and they're doing fine. The part-time farmer is a rule, they are, because they got their income off the farm. And then we got this middle class, the family farmer, which we all started out years and years ago, who make their living from farming. Well, they're the people that are in trouble. That's the ones we hear screaming right now. The big farmer, all the government programs seem to support him. Now, can you imagine to cut production in milk, we need to pay some corporation in Georgia and some in Florida $1 million and $1.5 million to cut their milk production 30%? And pay that out of the United States Treasury? I don't think we can do it that way. And every time those big farmers get in financial trouble, they're not the most efficient. And don't you ever believe it. Records don't bear that out at all. The most efficient farmer is the family-type farm. But all the programs are stacked in favor of the large farmers. So I think the large farmers have got themselves established and maintain their superiority through government programs. And just like we saw on television last year or a year before during the PIC program, a farmer in California drew $3 million in rice subsidies and his land was underwater all year. He couldn't even put that land in rice anyways. One of those years when it had flooding and so forth. The land that he was drawing the money on stayed underwater the entire summer. It couldn't have even been put in a crop that year. And some of your rice land works that way occasionally. When you have floods, you can't put it in. If you don't, you know, if it's an extremely wet year, you just don't get it dry in time to get the crop in. So he was still drawing a $3 million subsidy to cut his production on land he couldn't have planted anyway.
Having said all this, do you think it's possible for the small farmer to compete today with the larger farmers, corporations?
Oh yes, if you put him on an equal basis. Let him have an equal opportunity as the big farmer. I think there's no question he can.
But considering the government policies and everything, what I'm trying to get at is there a future for the small farmer? What's going to have to happen?
Well, no, there's just two groups you're going to get in. I mentioned these three groups of farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The middle class is getting smaller. The old family type farms. You're going to have to make two ripples. You're either going to get up in the big class or you're going down the other one. Now, I'm talking about 20 years from now, that middle group is not going to be in existence. And you'll find one occasionally, and he'll be a rarity, and you'll want to interview him because he'll be a rare breed. You're going to either get up in the big one or you're going to get down in the little one and be a part-time farmer and go to town and get you a job if you can find one.
That's dairy and beef cattle?
That's all farmers.
All farmers, period.
All farmers. It doesn't matter where you're dairy, beef, or crop, or sheep, or whatever. You're going to get in your three categories of farmer, and that's big, the family type, and the small-time farmer, and you're going to get out of the family type farm and get in the big one, or they're going to be a small farmer. That's the way I see it. And the government says that's happening, but he doesn't know how to stop it. And I think it'll end up costing the consumer a whole lot more money for their food when we get all of it in big-type farmers, too.
Well, what needs to be done if this is not going to happen? Do we need new governmental policies, or is...
Well, we're right now, of course, in the process of writing a new farm bill. I doubt that the government can write a farm. I believe in one part of Reagan's program. But of course, like I said, he's carried us along in an artificial market. So long that you can't just drop us out now and put us right back on the, what to call the world market, you know. In other words, a market-oriented agriculture. Now, it sounds stupid that we ever got off of a market-oriented agriculture, isn't it? That's where it always should. You should have always produced your milk and sold it for what you can get for it, the best you can get for it, not some artificial price. Because that sends wrong signals to the fellow who's decided to produce more milk or less milk. He thinks it's really a demand for milk because he's getting a good price, but it might be it's an artificial price. That's what the government... What we need is the government out. No agriculture, not only in this country, in the history of the world, has ever operated when it was operated by a government. Doesn't Russia have a little problem with her agriculture? She operates with a government. He makes all the decisions. And see, that's in reality, that's what the government does with these financial programs he does with us. You don't make sound, logical decisions of what you should do on a market-oriented basis or on a crop-rotating basis. You make it on what the government's paying. And that's not the right way to do it. And it's proven since 1930 to 1980 it wasn't the right way to do it. And can you think of, just example, Argentina. Today can't pay her bills. But did you know before government got into involved in her agriculture at the turn of the century in the early 1900s, she was a world exporter of agriculture products and quite rich country and had a quite high standard of living. Today she can't pay her bills because the government wanted to make all the decisions. So agriculture's never worked very good anywhere where the government makes all the decisions. I still believe in capitalism and free enterprise. I think you already have the right in America to go broke. And I think you also, with that right, you got a right to make a million if you so desire. And when you take the right for me to go broke away from me, you're going to make me a substandard socialist type of government, then I'll give up my right to be a millionaire if I so desire to try to be a millionaire. That's the way I feel about it.
Okay, one other question. I usually end up with this question for some reason, and that is, would you recommend young people coming out of college or high school or whatever, would you recommend that they go into farming in today's society?
Well, that would depend on a lot of things. I can assure them, by looking back on 30 years, that it would be a tremendous price to have to pay. And that's one thing that I've doubted over the years. You asked me a while ago, did I ever consider getting out of farming? Possibly no, I never have considered getting out of farming. It's sort of like anything else you get in. You know, you get in, you've been so long, you've paid such a price that it's hard to get out. But now if you start from scratch and got 30 years to get to where I am, and today I tell you the price would be high and sacrifices. But yet, in another way, I guess if you're successful or reasonably successful in anything you do, you have to pay a terrible price. And one thing about a farmer, he gets to make his decisions. That's the thing I liked about it. Where I might make that same, I was offered a job with Federal Land Bank when I got out of college, as an example. And it was making twice as much money as I ever dreamed making a farmer at that time. In my opinion, if I had went with Federal Land Bank, I could have stayed with them and been successful, I think. But here they are, in my opinion, in 1985, and they're broke. I'm not broke. I own my farm, and I'm still here. And I intend to be here in 2000. So that's one thing I like about farming. If you're willing to sacrifice and make the sacrifice, you'll be successful. Now, and that's just not easy words to say. And that you have to make a lot of hard decisions if you're going to be stay out here and be a family farmer. And even in the bad years, you've got to believe that next year will be better. And if you, whenever you reach the point that you don't think it will, then you're through as a farmer. You've got to always believe next year's better. Sort of like the fella, we'll beat you next year. You know, you always beat me in football, but we'll get you next year. You've got to believe that or you won't even show up for next year's game.
Yeah, I'm a Chicago Cubs fan, and I can identify.
You can understand that, can't you? You got to believe in next year.
Thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate it. It's been an interesting and informative session.
Thank you, Dave.